Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is RFERL Moscow correspondent Matthew Luxmoor. I'd like to talk about how things stand now with jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny, and also about the Kremlin's efforts to rein in the internet. Let's start with Navalny. Still less than 2 months since he returned to Russia following treatment in Germany for a severe nerve agent poisoning that he blames on President Vladimir Putin. But a lot has happened. Navalny was arrested upon arrival on January 17th, and a couple of weeks later was ordered to serve about 2.5 years in prison as a result of a parole violation claim that he calls absurd, since he was in Germany recovering from the poisoning at the time of the alleged infraction. And that's in a case that he and many others contend was politically motivated in the first place. Nonetheless, in late February, after he lost his appeal, as expected, the Russian authorities said that Navalny was being moved from the Moscow jail where he had been held. The assumption was and is that he's being sent to a prison somewhere in Russia to serve the sentence. And there were numerous reports quickly that his destination was EK2 in Pokrov, the prison in Pokrov in the Vladimir Oblast east of Moscow. This has been described by former inmates as a bleak place where the goal of the prison administration seems to be essentially to break inmates' will by applying constant pressures. Bit of a metaphor maybe for the treatment of the opposition in general. Now, so far, it appears that Navalny is not there yet, if he is indeed being sent there. That's still, I think, the general assumption. But on March 3rd, he said on Instagram that he was at a detention center in another town in the Vladimir Oblast. This is likely to be temporary, as Russians sentenced to years in prison normally serve those terms in prisons, not in temporary holding facilities. And meanwhile, the big nationwide protests held after Navalny's arrival and arrest and jailing ended over a month ago, and his backers suggested that they might not seek to stage another one until spring. Now, Matthew, what's your and meanwhile there have been sanctions imposed by the West over the situation with Navalny. What's your take, Matthew, on the current standing or the current situation? Will there be further standoffs, you think, between protesters and the state ahead of the parliamentary elections expected in September?
Hi, Steve. Yeah, the situation, of course, remains very tense in Russia, and the authorities continue to make very clear to political activists that they won't brook any dissent ahead of these parliamentary elections in September. Now, Navalny has nurtured a network of regional offices across Russia, and their coordinators are among his most dedicated and determined supporters. And those coordinators are now being targeted, essentially one by one. Many of them were jailed in advance of the January protests across Russia on charges of organizing them, mm-hmm. and others have been jailed since. Some of them are, of course, out of jails now. Others are still in jail awaiting release. Some are facing criminal charges, including the 24-year-old Navalny coordinator in Kurgan, which is a city near the border with Kazakhstan, who's accused of publishing classified information after he posted audio of a leaked phone call between two regional officials who appear on the phone call to be plotting election fraud. Also worth mentioning, the five prominent Navalny allies in Moscow are currently awaiting trial on charges that they put people's safety at risk by advocating mass gatherings during a pandemic, which they, of course, say is very hypocritical, considering that the Kremlin is accused of organizing so-called flash mobs where Putin supporters come out and chant his name, including in closed facilities, which obviously you'd assume would put people at risk of infection as well. Also, foreign students accused of participating in the protests being deported. And across Russia, schools and universities are hosting lectures about the dangers of protests and kind of pushing the baseless claim on which the Kremlin's narrative about them is based, which is that they're all a Western plot to destabilize Russia. So I think, you know, putting all that together, I think we can certainly speak of a concerted campaign to stamp out any opposition ahead of the vote. And it's this campaign and the police violence we saw during the recent protests that's prompted the decision by Navalny's allies a few weeks ago not to organize further street protests in coming weeks, which, you know, it's a decision that disappointed many of his supporters. But considering the prosecutions we've seen since, was perhaps prescient in many ways. All that said, Navalny's team is continuing with its investigations into corruption, for which it's become famous beyond Russia, especially after the recent probe into Putin's alleged palace, which you mentioned in the introduction. And it also plans further protests ahead of the September vote. So I think the state crackdown continuing at the moment is largely being executed with that prospect in mind, with the prospect of potential future protests, because, of course, warmer weather and especially any evidence of election fraud that's, manipulation that surfaces ahead or during the election is likely to swell the number of protesters on the streets and potentially create an unmanageable situation for the authorities. So a lot to follow, certainly, and it remains a very tense situation politically, despite the fact that there are currently no protests.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just mention another, and it's a great rundown, just mention another kind of factor that's resulted from Navalny's return and his, efforts since then is that, you know, in the kind of loyal opposition, the opposition or the parties that are not United Russia, but do have representation in the Duma, which is being elected in September, presumably, you know, there are people who are supporting Navalny. His return essentially has created some rifts in these parties, particularly the communists, which are used. These parties obviously are used, to kind of fill out the United Russia majority and keep things in line. So that's I'm sort of not aware of how big a factor that is, but it's something going into the elections, you know, in which obviously United Russia is particularly unpopular and has low ratings. So you know, as the spring arrives and goes on and summer arrives, we'll see to what degree those kind of factors are changing the calculations ahead of the elections, I think. I'd like to move on, I guess, to the internet discussion. I guess I'll segue by pointing out that the internet has been a crucial medium for Navalny in terms of getting his message out in a country where the state controls the main TV channels and has essentially since shortly after Putin became president first in 2000. Navalny's made statements on social media, of course, and his investigative outfit's reports on alleged corruption in Putin's circles, such as the investigation that was released shortly after his arrival and arrest into a sprawling Black Sea estate that he alleges was built for Putin at an immense cost. Some of these have found an audience of millions or tens of millions on YouTube. And meanwhile, Kremlin efforts to rein in the internet have had mixed results in the past few years. An example is the Russian state's failure to implement a ban on the Telegram app. Matthew, what do you think? Is the Kremlin stepping up efforts to control the internet in Russia as the State Duma elections and the end of Putin's current term in 2024 draw closer?
Yes, I think this is, you could call this the kind of less visible component of the current crackdown, which, we were discussing earlier. In recent weeks, as you mentioned, high-placed officials, including Putin himself on a couple of occasions, have been coming out with statements attacking the malign influence of the internet on Russia's youth, which is a line that they've been pushing for a long time now, and openly advocating some kind of censorship. Part of the issue, of course, is that material posted online is increasingly beginning to encroach in terms of reach on the influence that's long been wielded by the state-controlled television channels. And, you know, relatively unregulated social media platforms like TikTok and YouTube are wildly popular in Russia, and I think becoming more so. So the government's campaign, it also extends, of course, beyond this latest push to rein in dissent. I mean, Russia for years has sought to assert greater control over the internet with mixed results, as you noted. Many analysts say that while China was able to institute its so-called firewall pretty early on, Russia's in many ways missed the boat. I mean, the internet today is so unwieldy and complex that there's no kind of single barrier that can be erected by governments to make sure citizens see only what they should, especially if they haven't put serious measures in place a long time ago. At the same time, I mean, the suite of VPNs and other tools available to Russians has made more piecemeal efforts by the government difficult to enforce. Telegram, as you said, the messaging app, was easily accessible through a VPN during the two-year-long attempt to block it in Russia. And the government has also spent millions on a search engine called Sputnik, which essentially came to naught. RuTube, which is kind of Russia's YouTube equivalent, is hardly used in the country. So these efforts to kind of create an alternative suite of apps tech giants has kind of had limited reach in Russia. So I think what we're kind of seeing instead, you know, after 8 years of the government trying to block websites that still remain accessible through VPNs and other proxy methods, is kind of a campaign of attrition. Russia's new law on the sovereign internet, you know, it's enabled authorities to filter incoming and outgoing traffic. And then another filter is being introduced, which obligates big tech active in Russia to censor banned content or face pretty substantial fines. And some platforms, as we've seen, have been paying those fines, perhaps because, you know, it's a lesser evil than changing their policies to meet Russia's demands. So, you know, in sum, I think it's definitely something to watch, and it's possible that we may, in coming years, see entire social media platforms being blocked by the government, I think, if things continue proceeding in the pace that they've been going recently. At the same time, what seems to have held the government in check or held them back from such moves so far, beyond, you know, simple technological shortcomings, has, I think, been purely, you know, economic reasons. I mean, many Russian companies and government officials rely on the infrastructure of, you know, tech giants like Amazon or Facebook, whether for public outreach or advertising or for their internal operations. So there is pressure from business against any rash, you know, drastic moves by the authorities. And I think the big question going forward will be, you know, which side will ultimately win out in this standoff, and what compromises, if any, will be struck.
Right. So, I mean, that's a great explanation. It sounds like, to some degree, there's kind of a debate, or it's a question of, you know, to what degree will Russia try to kind of isolate itself, you know, in terms of the internet. And how that will play out. Meanwhile, as you say, I think they're kind of implementing or trying to implement kind of piecemeal measures here and there to increase the state's control. All right, we're going to have to wrap it up for today. Matthew, thanks very much for joining me.
Sure, always a pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
All right, thanks. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please keep an eye out on Friday for my Week in Russia newsletter. Thanks for listening.